Welcome to Writer's Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline, is not with us today, but you can catch her next week. However, we have a really interesting guest. She's a second-time guest on Writer's Voices, although it's been a few years. Marie Lu is the number one New York Times best-selling author of the Young Elite series, as well as the blockbuster best-selling Legend series. And we interviewed Marie some years ago with one of the books from the Young Elites, which was fascinating, really fun. She graduated from the University of Southern California and jumped into the video game industry as an artist. Now a full-time writer, Marie spends her spare time reading, drawing, playing games, and getting stuck in traffic. She lives in Los Angeles, California, with her illustrator-author husband, Primo Gallinosa, and their dogs. Welcome back to Writer's Voices, Marie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back on.
Of course. Now, you grew up in California as well, also, right?
I actually grew up in Houston, Texas.
I moved to LA
for college. I went to USC.
And did you always want to be a writer?
I always loved writing. I didn't know that writing or being a writer was a profession that you could pursue until I was in high school. So that was when I was more serious about it and started trying to write with the goal of publication. But it took me a while to realize that. So before that, I just kind of liked, you know, stapling together stories for myself and I don't know where I thought books came from. They were just there at the library. I didn't think too much about it.
Well, the book we're talking about today is Wild Card, and it is book two, I believe, in the Warcross series.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's the sequel to Warcross, and I'm guessing that there may be more in this series.
The second book, Wild Card, is the end of the duology for now.
Okay.
But, you know, maybe in the future there may be spinoffs or companion novels, but no plans for now to continue it. It's just a duology.
Well, I guess I assume there was, because normally it seems like these books come in threes.
Yeah, this is my first time writing a duology. Both of my books have been trilogies.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. In fact, that's what I want to talk about a lot today, is writing a series. And particularly a young adult, sort of futuristic, not exactly fantasy, sci-fi. It's a little bit of sci-fi, although it's really not, doesn't seem all that far-fetched.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely the most near future sci-fi that I've written. It's pretty much taking place in our present day. And to be honest, I think most of the science fiction in it is not science fiction. I think everything mentioned in the book has either already been invented or is in the process of being created in the real world. So it's almost contemporary, which is kind of unsettling.
I know. And let me actually give a little brief introduction to the book. The main character is Emeka Chen. Did I say that right?
I've been saying it Emeka, but Emeka is also very common for my readers, so that's fine too.
So Emeka Chen barely made it out of the Warcross Championships alive. Now, Warcross is a virtual reality game. So we'll talk a little bit more about what that means. But now that she knows the truth behind Hideo's new Neuralink algorithm, she can no longer trust the one person she's always looked up to, who she once thought was on her side. Determined to put a stop to Hideo's grim plans, Emeka and the Phoenix Riders band together only to find a new threat lurking on the neon-lit streets of Tokyo. Someone's put a bounty on Amika's head, and her sole chance for survival lies with Zero and the Black Coats, his ruthless crew. But Emeka soon learns that Zero isn't all that he seems, and his protection comes at a price. So it's, you know, you've got all kinds of elements in this story. You've got the sci-fi element, you've got the adventure, you've got the romance, and how do you weave all those together in a world that is so like and yet so different from the world we actually live in?
Well, thank you. It was really hard. I had a hard time writing the second book because there was so much going on in it. There's Amika at the center of this storm of events, and people on all sides of this conflict who all want different things and believe in different things and have different moral compasses. And I wanted to make it in such a way where you weren't entirely sure who was right. It's a very morally gray story, so Amika has to rely on her own moral compass and her belief in herself and what she thinks is right to guide her, because sometimes it's not entirely clear to her exactly who the bad guy is. It's kind of mirrored on what, you know, my own feelings about technology and how, you know, there's both good and bad things that come with technology. So a lot of those questions went into Wildcard. And I think part of what made it so difficult to explore is that there's just so many facets of that. So her romance is kind of the same way. You know, she has this very push and pull relationship with Hideo, where the two of them can't seem to stay away from each other, but also can't seem to work together or function together or anything. But, you know, they're just constantly trying to figure each other out and play this game, you know, both literally and figuratively that they've been thrown into. And Zero plays a huge role in all of that too. So it was hard weaving it all together. I think I kind of did it one layer at a time as I was drafting it. So first I was trying to get down the plot and figure out where everyone stood on their beliefs, and eventually, you know, the romance weaved in, and so it took a while. I think I must have done at least 5 or 6 huge revisions on this book.
Wow. When mm-hmm. you started creating the world for Warcross, did you have in mind initially that this would be a duology?
I did. This is actually, I think, the first time that I ever knew for sure how many books was going to be in a series. I usually don't know, you know, with Legend and with the Young Elites, with both of them, I had no idea if they were going to fit into 3 or not when I began. And so it was kind of chaotic in that sense. But with Warcross, I always knew they would fit pretty neatly into a duology. It just followed Amika's arc very, very neatly.
So how much of the story, of the story arc, do you have kind of nailed down before you even start writing?
In the case of Warcross, I knew what would happen at the end of the first book, and I knew what was going to happen at the end of the second book. I knew some of the big plot points in each of the books, but outside of that, it was all open. I'm very much a, you know, a pantser, like I write by the seat of my pants, and I try to outline, but it never really carries through. I always end up, you know, changing my mind or going off the rails pretty early on in my books. So I've learned over time that maybe that's just my quote unquote process. It's just really all chaos all the time.
You managed to clarify it pretty well by the time you're finished.
Thank you. I'm relieved to hear that.
Do you start with a character, a situation, both?
Mm-hmm. Usually it's with character. I think in Warcross's case, it was a little bit different. Usually I start with a character. So Legend, the first inkling I had for Legend was the two main characters. It was Day and June, and the world came about after I created them. With the Young Elites, it was the same. Adelina was always the protagonist / antagonist of the story, and everything else came after her. But with Warcross originally came from an idea actually in my Legend trilogy that I didn't get a chance to flesh out. So at the end of the Legend trilogy, there is mention of a society in futuristic Antarctica that is completely gamified. So everything about this society is a game. You know, you level up in life, you have a level, and everything you do, like from watering your plant to taking a test, gets calculated into that score. And based on your score, you know, you are allowed to like buy a house or take the bus or whatever in the society. And I was always fascinated by that concept of a gamified society, and I only got to explore it for a couple of chapters in Legends. But I always wanted to go back to the idea of a game that people are obsessed with. So that was the first inkling for Warcross, and it took me a few more years to find the rest of the story. And then when I did, the first thing that came out of it was Amika. So she was very, very early on. So I would say that in the case of Warcross, it was a little bit of both. It was me coming up with Amika Chen as a protagonist, and the world, the rest of the world fleshing out around her and what she does as a bounty hunter and a hacker. But like the very, very first seed for the story was the idea of a game world.
Interesting. Now, in Warcross, the game is, it's kind of like the game is a little bit separate from the world,
mm-hmm.
but everybody right. seems to be involved in it. In one way or another.
Right, as in everyone in the world plays the game in some way or other.
Yeah. And the tournaments are well, tell us a little bit about the, like, the tournament, which is sort of a central point. It seemed like mm-hmm. that was more in the first book.
Right. So you're absolutely right. The world of Warcross, Warcross itself is a game. It's two teams of five who are pitted against each other in virtual worlds. And this can be watched by as many people around the world as, you know, as want to, who want to watch it. The game itself has taken the world by storm. Everybody loves this game. Everybody plays it. And it's run on a system called the Neuralink. And this is something that Hideo created. It's a virtual reality platform. And an augmented reality platform where you wear, you know, these glasses in order to see it. And then later on in the story, you wear contact lenses. So you're basically involved seamlessly in this interface. And you walk around the world seeing virtual overlays over everything. So the Neuralink is the overarching interface upon which Warcross the game is run. And pretty much everyone is hooked up to the Neuralink. It's basically the Matrix. You know, you can go anywhere in the world that you want to in the Neuralink virtually. You can walk down the street and have augmented reality overlaid over everything. You know, you'll see street names hovering over your face, and you can see people with like virtual hair dyes and angel wings and pet, you know, virtual pets walking with them. It's like a hyper surreal version of society. Yeah, and then the tournaments themselves are championship tournaments that are played on a professional level by the best players of Warcross in the world. And those players are international celebrities. Like, everybody knows them. They're basically like Beyonce, you know.
Do you think that this could really be our reality in the future?
I would say it's not far-fetched. The game itself of Warcross is based on the current esports world, which mm-hmm. is, you know, professional gaming. And it was loosely based on League of Legends specifically, which is a very popular game that is, you know, in the esports world. And that's already, you know, that already exists. And I went to the international championship of League of Legends a few years ago and went to the Staples Center. That's where it was being held, and it was just mind-boggling how huge it was. I felt like I was watching, you know, like a basketball game from the future. It was really, really cool. You know, the stadium was packed to the rafters. There was an overflow tournament across the street. It would just felt like the biggest event in the world. And I wanted to emulate that.
But how did you watch it? Was everything on big screens in that case?
Yeah, everything was on a big screen. They had holograms in the middle of the arena like huge holograms in this square that showed, you know, replays of past gameplay and ads and stuff. And they had, you know, on the giant jumbotrons that are in the Staples Center, the actual game. And then on the floor, you had the two teams on opposite sides of the court. So it was just a very, very strange, surreal, really interesting thing to watch. I really did feel like I was in the future. So that already exists. And the technology, you know, for virtual reality is already here, if, you know, much more rudimentary than what is displayed in Warcross. And I don't think we're that far away from doing something like that. And I know that Elon Musk is already, like, my editor sent me this article a while back where she's like, Elon Musk is inventing a brain-computer interface that he's calling the Neuralink.
Oh, no.
Which was very, yeah, it was very unsettling to hear. It's a chip that you install on your brain, and it connects you seamlessly to the internet. And I was like, oh, my God. So all of it is happening, and I really don't think it's far-fetched to think that it might come to pass.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Marie Lu, author of Wild Card, It's Time for a Rematch, the sequel to Warcross. When you're creating these worlds for a series, how do you keep track of all the rules in the world?
It's hard. A lot of the rules for me tend to change as I'm drafting, because I tend to create about half of the world before I write my first draft, and then the rest of the world falls into place as I'm finishing that first draft. So I tend to keep a Bible of all of the world building, and that kind of helps me keep track of everything. So I've got this one giant document that I refer to for Warcross, and it has everything from how the Neuralink glasses work to how the contact lenses work to how the game of Warcross is played, all of the rules, all of the power-ups, you know, all of the players and teams that make up the game, which countries, you know, play it the most, what does futuristic Tokyo look like, and so on and so forth, like all the character profiles and detailed information about each character, and like a rough outline of major plot points. So all of that is in this one giant document that I use to refer to. When I'm working with my editor on it, my copy editor tends to create a master document as well that documents a lot of terminology and little details about the world building that she uses to keep track of everything that's in the story, so that when she catches discrepancies, she'll let me know and alert me in the document, where she's like, you know, this game doesn't make sense. Like, you have, you know, points here and then they don't add up over here and those little things. So especially with this series, it took a lot of finagling to make sure that everything was, you know, in line and made sense. But that's usually how I do it.
Now, you worked in the gaming industry.
Mm-hmm.
And were you designing games?
I was an artist. So I would create prototypes for games or segments of games, like little things you could, you know, like with the buttons and the interfaces, just like a little sample of what things would look like in the game. So it was a kind of combination artist design job.
But you weren't actually writing the rules of the
No.
world of the game.
No, I wasn't a game designer.
And
I would have loved to have been.
Yeah. Well, you ended up being one, actually.
Yeah.
Just in a different format.
Yeah.
So, are you a gamer?
Yeah. I mean, I don't play as much now as I used to, just because of a lack of time. But if I could, I would be playing a lot more. I've loved games since I was a kid, so it's always been a part of my life.
Now, you emigrated to the U.S. from China when you were a child, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And where in China did you come from?
Beijing.
Beijing. I was just in China last week.
And oh, really?
Yeah. I was
Very
in Shenzhen.
Cool. What part?
Shenzhen, oh, nice. And then Hong Kong and Macau.
Wow.
And it really is different than the U.S. There's mm-hmm. no doubt about
yeah.
that. Yeah. It's very Absolutely. Interesting. This mm-hmm. is my second time over there. I go on business. And
very cool.
Yeah, it is really cool. And you set your book in Japan, in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And why did you choose Tokyo?
I chose Japan specifically because I feel like I needed to pay homage to the fact that Japan is where our modern gaming world comes from. Like the industry, the way it is, it basically originated in Japan. You know, we have Nintendo, we have Sony, Sega, like that all came from Japan. So if you go to Tokyo now, gaming is such a part of life in a way that it's not quite yet here. They've got huge gaming halls and, you know, buildings, 5 or 6 story buildings that are just dedicated to games. So
wow.
It felt right, you know, to set the story there.
Have you spent much time in Tokyo?
I've been there a couple of times, both for research for Warcross. So that's the main reason why the books are written in a way where Emika is a tourist to Japan. She's kind of scratching the surface of this futuristic Tokyo, and that's very much how I experienced Tokyo. You know, not as a resident or anything like that, but just as somebody who was there for the first time and just completely dazzled and overwhelmed by how futuristic and different and colorful it was.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Marie Lu, a number one New York Times bestselling author of Wild Card, which is book 2, the sequel to Warcross. Now, Emika Chan, of course, is a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And your protagonists have always been female. Is that true?
Almost always, yeah. In Legend, June was one of the protagonists, and Day, who was a boy, was the second protagonist.
Okay.
But other than that, I think everybody has been a girl, yeah.
So it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like mm-hmm. the young adult sort of futuristic sci-fi fantasy, particularly dystopian fiction, which I wouldn't really put this in the dystopian category, but
mm-hmm.
Female protagonists seem to be very, very popular in that genre.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
I think maybe because there has been a dearth of them in the past.
Yeah.
You know, when I read fantasy and science fiction when I was growing up, almost no book starred young girls or females of any kind, let alone, you know, female protagonists. And it never really occurred to me that you could have a female protagonist, or that maybe that was something that was sorely lacking in the genre. So I, you know, when I was a kid writing my, you know, first science fiction and fantasy manuscripts, I always had a boy at the center of those stories, because it just, that's all I knew. And it wasn't until I read my first fantasy novel that had a female protagonist in it that I realized how skewed that was. That book was Kushiel's Dart by Jacqueline Carey. And it absolutely changed both how I read and how I saw, you know, the science fiction and fantasy genres. And I think it takes, like, at first you just don't realize those things until, you know, you see it and you're like, oh my God, this is so lopsided, you know, but we all kind of take it for granted that it's normal for boys to be the stars of these genres. And now, you know, you see a lot of the stories that broke out early on mm-hmm. in science fiction and fantasy, especially in young, you know, young adult and children's books, Harry Potter, Twilight, The Hunger Games, and Divergent. Like these stories, you know, with the exception of Harry Potter, although Hermione's my favorite character from that world, they're all starring young girls. with varying types of agency. And I think it's because no one had been catering to girls who are ravenous readers. And to be able to see yourself suddenly appear in a story in a genre that, you know, originally has been very and still is quite hostile to, you know, women characters, I think young girls, especially, you know, I was one of those girls, were absolutely, you know, thrilled and delighted by that. And so you see these phenomenons happening where we're like, oh my God, I had no idea that I could read something like this, you know, and see my a young woman at the starring, you know, at the center of a world like this. And like the Hunger, I was captivated by the Hunger Games and by Katniss. There just weren't a lot of stories like that.
Well, even as as an adult, I found that too, because I grew up not, there weren't any female adventure heroines at all. I mean, we had Jane Eyre, for Pete's sake.
Yeah, there was Jane Eyre, and there was Anne of Green Gables, and that was
Nancy Drew. There was Nancy Drew.
And Nancy Drew. I love Nancy Drew. Yeah.
Yeah, we did have Nancy Drew.
We did. Yeah, and but it's like you could count them on one hand. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah, and now I think people realized not only that there was such a lack, but that there's a huge demand for this, and that we have been neglecting a full half of the population.
Well, the conventional wisdom used to be that boys would not read a story with a female protagonist, but girls would read a story with a male protagonist.
Right.
Do you think that's still true at all?
I think maybe to a certain extent is true only because that is the way that society and adults pitch it to boys. I think if boys were just allowed to explore on their own, I don't think they would care at all.
Yeah.
You know, but we as a society have a tendency to shame boys for liking things that are feminine and appreciating things that star women. You know, if like I've experienced this myself at bookstore signings or events or at school events where a boy will wait until everyone else has left before he comes up to me and says, you know, I really like the romance in your story. Because he can't say that out loud. You know, if there's a this is the flip side of feminism, like of misogyny, where boys are kind of unconsciously taught over and over again by the adults in their lives that, you know, it's weird and bad to like what's considered feminine. You know, it's like boys don't like princesses and boys don't like romance and boys don't, you know, like the soft things, the feminine things. And if you do, you are teased mercilessly for it. And so out of that come this generation of boys who are like, I don't touch things written by women. You know, I don't consume content starring women. I don't touch things that are considered feminine. And they grow up into, you know, men who feel very strictly regimented to conventionally masculine things. Like, I can like football and I can like, you know, beer and that's it. Like, that's my range of interest that I'm allowed to have without being taunted mercilessly by other people. So I think it's a huge, huge complicated problem.
And isn't this problem even, you know, really at the forefront in the gaming world?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. And I think it goes back to that fear of, oh my God, if I like something that girls like, that means that I'm not a man or I'm a lesser boy. And so there's this resistance to having women in gaming, both behind the scenes in the industry and as professional gamers.
It's really gone. I mean, I don't know that much about it, but I've seen some of the news stories where it's like, I mean.
Yeah, it's like Gamergate was this fiasco that happened several years ago. And it was basically this huge backlash against women in games, and women would find themselves doxxed, you know, online, their personal information exposed, harassed off of the internet for voicing their criticisms of the problems inherent in both video game content and in the video game world.
So have you gotten any pushback because, you know, here you're writing books about these amazing video games and the best players are some of the best players are women?
Yeah, I get the occasional message, you know, from people who think that, oh, this is not for this is unrealistic to have, you know, women in these roles or whatever. But overall, I am overwhelmingly the feedback is overwhelming from young women who are gamers, who are like, I'm so glad and excited to see a story with a girl gamer, and a girl tech person and a girl hacker, in these kind of traditionally very suffocatingly male dominated areas. And that has been very heartening to see. I mean, I know a lot of gamer girls who, you know, love games, but don't really talk about it, and they don't, you know, advertise it online for fear of being harassed, and, you know, it can get very ugly. So I wanted to write something for them. Well, because, you know, I'm a gamer
girl. I'm glad you did, and I think that society is changing a little bit, and of course this is a very individual story, but my grandson is turning 9, so he's 8 at the moment. He's almost 9.
Sweet.
He loves Minecraft. He started playing Minecraft a couple years ago and almost immediately got really, really into it. And he does plays in creative mode. And he builds, builds these amazing worlds. He's got like a theme park world, and he's got a dinosaur world, and he's got all these worlds. Well, his little sister, who just turned 6, so it's, this would have been when she was 5, he taught her how to play. She got really into it. And when I heard that, and they play side by side on their iPads, but they can, if they're on the same IP address, they can see and get into each other's worlds. He plays on the TV with the joystick and so forth, but the iPad with the touch screen is a little easier for her. And but the cutest thing, I said, so I hear you taught your sister to play Minecraft. He goes, yes, and she's an expert.
Oh, I love that so much. That's so great. I'm so glad they play together and that he's so supportive of his sister.
Yeah.
I love it.
And they love to play it together. It's so cool.
So great. It's so cool to hear. And I think that if more adults were accepting that kind of behavior, I think boys would feel much less pressured to, you know, be hostile.
Yeah.
And these types of things, you know? So I think that's so great. Good for him.
Yeah.
And good for her, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she definitely wants to emulate her brother in just about everything. And so at the moment, she's doesn't like princesses anymore. You know, no Disney princesses. she only likes things that her brother likes, you know, Jurassic World and Godzilla. But she does make room for Hello Kitty.
Nice. And, oh, I love Hello Kitty. I still love Hello Kitty.
And Peppa the Pig.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Good choices.
Yeah. So I do think that kids today, you know, they're growing up really where video games and the whole computer world is so natural to them. I mean, my granddaughter literally learned to crawl so to get to the laptop.
Wow.
And by the age of 2, you know, she knew how to look for surprise egg videos in YouTube, which was her favorite thing.
Wow.
Or, I don't know if you know That's about incredible. Surprise eggs.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the YouTube is a whole strange new thing for me. Like this, there's like this a slime phenomenon where young people love watching videos of how to make slime.
Oh my god!
Like unboxing videos where they just watch people unbox gifts.
It's a really fascinating thing. They love that when they were a little bit
small. Yeah,
they would watch. And there's this one little boy on there who tries out all the toys and basically does reviews of all these toys. And, yeah, they love that stuff.
It's so fascinating to me.
So let's go back to the world of Warcross. Tell me a little bit about, was it the Dark World?
The Dark World, right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Dark World is the virtual reality equivalent of the Dark Web, which is in the real, like in our world, we have the Dark Web, or the Dark Net, and that's basically the part of the internet that you can't access on like Google, or like you can't just go on a regular search engine to find. You have to kind of know your way around the internet to be able to get to these like dark websites. And they're quote unquote dark because, you know, they're not linked to anything. They're not hooked up to, you know, what people can usually access. So you kind of have to have some computer know-how to access the dark net, the dark web. And I've never been on there because it scares me. But that's the underworld of the internet, essentially, in our world. And, you know, a lot of weird things happen on there. I know people sell drugs on there. It's just, you know, the place where, like, illegal stuff happens. And I figure that in a world like Warcross, where the internet has really become, you know, the Neuralink is the new, like, three-dimensional, immersive version of the internet, there's going to be a version of the dark web in this world as well. So for me, I decided to call that the dark world. And it is a virtual place that you literally can, or virtually can step into. And you walk the streets of this virtual place that you can't access unless you know what you're doing as a hacker. And it looks like a city, but it's this city that doesn't really make sense. It's kind of like an Escher-like city. It's very dark. There's neon signs everywhere that expose people's information if you happen to not know how to protect yourself down there. And it's where all the hackers congregate. It's where drugs are sold. It's where, you know, criminal activity happens. In the case of Warcross, it's where they sell and resell, you know, illegal Warcross things. There's something called an assassination lottery, which is where people will bid on real life people that they want to see assassinated. And so they put money into the pot for those people, and it rises high enough, you know, some assassin out there is going to try to win that pot of money. And that is something that Amika gets involved in. And fun fact, the assassination lottery, as far as I can tell from a book that I read, is a real thing in our real dark web, in our world.
You're so kidding.
No, I was very, I was true to stranger than fiction. I read that, I was like, oh my God. I don't know if they've actually assassinated anybody of, you know, of note using that, but it's a little unsettling to know that that exists, you know.
How does money go back and forth between the virtual world and the real world?
In Warcross, they use something called notes, which is the virtual currency of the game. And because the game is so popular, people kind of accept notes as something almost as valuable as real life currency. And it's kind of mirrored off of, you know, virtual currency in our world, like Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So it's almost a replacement in the Warcross world for real money. Like there is real tangible value. People will accept, you know, notes for rent or for food or whatever. And it kind of keeps its value depending on where you are in the world, no matter what kind of real life currency you're using.
Now, when Amika was in the real world, she could wear a virtual disguise. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. That is part of the augmented reality part of the Neuralink. So if you're wearing the contact lenses in the Warcross world, which almost, you know, in this version of the world, like 98% of people are wearing these lenses when they go around the world. That means that you can see virtual overlays over your world. So you're walking down the street, you can see, you know, street signs floating in the air and building names floating in the air, or like virtual decorations in front of a, you know, in front of a store or something. So that means you can also, and they're all very hyper-realistic, so you can also see people, like people will download virtual skins on themselves, on their real bodies, So if other people are wearing the lenses and see you, they can see you with like a really cool new hairstyle, but it's actually a virtual projection onto your body. Or, you know, like I have a pet tiger and it's walking right beside me. And if I'm wearing the lenses and you're wearing the lenses, I can see your pet tiger as if it's a real tiger walking beside you. So it's kind of like my extension, my hyper extension of what augmented reality could do. And so in that vein, if you want to wear a disguise, a virtual disguise that kind of scrambles your facial features, you can do that. You can download a skin. So Amika tends to do that a lot. She downloads virtual skins of faces that are not her own and just puts it on. And if you weren't wearing the lenses, you would see Amika obviously as herself. But if you are wearing lenses, you will see her behind this. You'll see this virtual disguise over her.
And if you're wearing the lenses, you can't like turn it off and on.
I mean, you can. The story gets a little bit more complicated about that later on, but in general, in theory, you can just take off the lenses and, you know, then you're logged out, or you can choose to turn it all off, you know, and then you see the regular world as it is. But most people don't, you know, they just, in this world, they're so used to it. It's kind of like us. We're just walking around on our phones all the time, like not even looking up. People just kind of accept it as part of their everyday lives.
Now, I read Wildcard without having read Warcross first.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
And
I hope it was easy to follow.
Pardon?
I hope it was easy to follow.
It was a little difficult. it was, you know, I'm very computer and tech savvy, so that made it probably a little easier for me than it might for somebody who's less technically oriented. But would you, you know, I guess when you write these books, they're really being written to read in order. Is that a
right.
accurate statement?
Right. Yeah. I would definitely recommend reading Warcross first before reading Wildcard, because the two Wildcard basically follows 2 days after the events of Warcross. So I could see it being a little bit confusing if you don't start with book
it
one.
It took me, you know, there were some aspects of it that took a little while to really understand, like her relationship with the different people. But mm-hmm. I think you gave enough hints and enough background. I guess that's my question.
Oh, good.
Do you deliberately try and put in enough sort of background of into the prior story or sort of references to the earlier story mm-hmm. so that someone could read this and you know, understand it, maybe not get as full an experience as if you'd read the first book, but understand it without having read the earlier book? Or also, if it's been a while since you've read the earlier book.
Right. And that's, I do try to put in a little bit of a recap in the first chapter just for, you know, readers of the first book who read it maybe when it first came out last year and are a little bit rusty on the details. So I do try my best to add in a little bit of, you know, previously on Warcross for people to catch up, you know, but the stories are not like companion novels or anything. Like, they don't really stand alone. They're best read in order. Yeah.
Right. In the beginning of this, of our talk, you talked a little bit about the kind of the morality and how your character had to sort of develop her own or really get to understand her own moral compass. And I wanted to delve into that a little more because, you know, Hideo is doing something that it's sort of like he's doing the wrong thing for the right reasons.
Right.
And
yeah,
that seems to happen a lot in the world.
Yeah.
And throughout history, where someone who gets a certain amount of power tries to use that power for good, but the concentration of power in and of itself, in a sense, is evil.
Right. Absolutely. And it was all kind of based on how our real tech industry is. It's something that I think about all the time. It keeps me awake at night, you know, thinking about the fact that you know, in our real world, our tech giants, like they tend to make things, I would like to think, they tend to make things in the beginning as, you know, with very good intentions. Like everybody tries to make things that connect people and help people and save lives and so on. But, you know, the best intentions can be warped if we're not ready for that. And I think that Hideo is a reflection of that kind of over-optimism, where he really, really believes that he is capable of controlling something that he actually cannot do, or that he has no business to be controlling. So it's something that I very much wanted to explore, this idea of, you know, how do you react when someone, especially someone you care about, is doing something that seems incredibly noble, from, you know, the good part of his heart, but going about it in completely the wrong way. I find it interesting and fascinating to toy with that. You know, it made him a more interesting character for me to write, and allowed me to kind of explore a lot of the my own thoughts on, you know, how things are happening in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, just and as an example of that, there have been many times where, well, let's look at Marxism, which was developed as, you know, to help people to, to, you know, there were people who were starving, who were oppressed, and it was supposed to bring them dignity and control over their own lives. But then it's at the cost of certain liberties and freedoms, and never seems to have played out or you know, been expressed in a way that actually was good, even though the intent was good.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, my mom's generation, you know, in China, went through the Cultural Revolution there and basically experienced firsthand what it was like for, you know, well-intentioned communism to go completely awry. It's really interesting to me that human, like we as a species, we keep trying to make these perfect things, like these perfect societies. We've always been like a overly ambitious species. You know, we think these really grand thoughts, and I think we forget sometimes that part of the definition of being human is that we are imperfect. Like we are capable of both amazing and truly terrible things. So it's interesting to me that in spite of that, we keep trying to do these things, you know, and they usually go awry, but it's interesting that they always start off in this place of, you know, good intentions or what they think are good intentions. It's just fascinating to me how that works.
Yeah, it certainly is. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Marie Lu, author of Wild Card. It's time for a rematch. Now, Marie, I read that The Young Elite is possibly being made into a movie.
I hope so. it's currently under option by 20th Century Fox, and that's pretty much all I know. I know there's a screenplay that's written, and I've seen it, and I like it a lot. But Hollywood is kind of its own, you know, beast. So I will just keep my fingers crossed and hope that something happens. Yeah.
How involved were you in the screenplay?
I was kind of a consultant on it. You know, I have no experience writing screenplays, so I didn't want to be the one doing it. So there was an experienced screenwriter working on it, and I was able to talk to her every now and then whenever she had questions about building out the world or fleshing out the characters, and so she would call me, and I would go over some of the stuff with her, and just to try to help capture the feel of the books for her. But that was basically the extent of my involvement. Yeah.
So is it? Do you know if it's being considered as a single movie or as a series?
I think they're. Well, the screenplay is of the first book for now, and I think ultimately if they were to actually make it, it would be three, but, you know, it's something that, again, is kind of out of my wheelhouse.
Right.
I just kind of hope that, you know, something gets made, and, you know, every now and then I'll hear something, but it's something that I feel very much outside of. Yeah.
It must be very exciting for you, though.
It is, yeah. I mean, I love films. I think it would be really interesting to see it as a film. It's one of those things that, like, I didn't even know to dream about. Like, I was as a kid, I knew to dream about being published as a, you know, as a novelist, to see my work as books. But having the option of potentially seeing them as movies is, it just came completely out of left field. And so I didn't, you know, it's not something that I ever knew to want. But, you know, now it's something that I think would be really, really cool.
Well, now, Marie, when you finish a series, do you miss the world? Do you miss the characters?
I do sometimes. Yeah. Like, I feel this weird sense of, like, I mean, I don't have kids yet, so I don't know if this is accurate, but like that feeling of, when you send off your kid to college and you've got an empty nest, I assume it's what that might feel like, where, you know, I've completed this series and taken these characters to the end of their journey. And now I imagine them kind of going off into the, wherever characters go, I guess, into the fantasy ether.
When you're writing, how absorbed are you in that world? Is there any difficulty sometimes transitioning back to the real world when you're done writing for the day?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, yeah. If I'm deep in the flow of writing, especially in my first drafts, you know, sometimes I'll blink and look up. I'm like, where am I? What time is it? You know, it's easy to get lost in that. And I love that feeling. Like, that's when I know that the writing is working and it's flowing and I'm actually immersing myself in the story. So I look forward to those moments when, you know, I actually do get lost in the world and have to drag myself back out into the real world.
Now, are you one of these writers that writes first drafts very quickly and sort of just pours everything out and then goes back later and edits, or are you one that edits as you write?
I'm usually the former, where I will spit out everything into a first draft, whether or not it makes sense, and then go back and revise over and over. But I wouldn't say I'm terribly fast at writing a first draft. It takes me several months, you know, at the fastest to write a draft. I have a lot of friends who can bust out a draft in a few weeks, and I don't know how they do it. But in general, yeah, I tend to write a very, very messy first draft where I just am exploring all the possibilities of the story. And then we'll spend the next year, you know, rewriting probably a third to a half of it.
Well, when was your first book published?
Legend was published in the fall of 2011.
And you've now published 8 books?
This is actually my 10th book.
10th?
So Wild Card is the number 10, yeah.
Wow. Okay, so 10 books in 7 years?
Yeah, I can't really believe it myself.
Wow. I mean, that's fast.
Thank you. I try my best to keep up.
Now, by the time Legend came out, how many did you already have completed? Had you finished writing at that point?
I had written 4 other novels that never got published. The Legend was number 5.
Wow.
Yeah, and those 4 happened over the span of like 12 years from the point when I first started trying to get published.
Wow. How did you actually find your publisher?
I found my agent first, and that was because I followed her blog a lot. My agent is Kristen Nelson of the Nelson Literary Agency, and she runs this fabulous blog called Pub Rants, where she gives a lot of advice on what publishers are looking for and how the industry works and how you write a query letter. Just really great advice. And I don't remember exactly how I stumbled on it, but I would follow it all the time. And so I always knew that I wanted to be her client. So I remember pitching her a couple of times, and she like rejected my first couple of manuscripts for very good reason. And I think my fourth manuscript was the one that finally got her as my my agent, and she was the one who started sending out the publishers. But that book actually never got published either. It was the second book that I had. Legend was the second book that I had with her, that I wrote while the first one was getting rejected. that we finally ended
up. So was that a rejection process hard? Obviously, it would be.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Early on, I mean, I'm grateful for it, but it was rough in the beginning. I think I must have accumulated like 500 or 600 rejection letters over time.
Wow.
For all those books. Yeah.
Wow. Well, congratulations on your success. So we're about out of time, but can you just tell me what's next?
Yeah. I've got a couple of books coming out in the next few years. The first one is next fall, 2019. It is the fourth book in the Legend series, fourth and final. It's a companion novel that takes place after the events of the original trilogy. And I'm kind of writing it as a homage to the fans of that series. Spring of 2020, I'm writing my first standalone fantasy novel. It's a historical fantasy called The Kingdom of Bach. And it will be about young Mozart as a child and his sister. So that's the standalone. And then in fall of 2020, I have the beginning of a new sci-fi fantasy series called Skyhunter. And that's pretty much all I can say about it for now. But I'm really excited, and I hope everyone likes them.
Wow, you're not slowing down at all.
No. I hope I get to keep the pace up for the foreseeable future.
Wow. Well, congratulations. And
thank you.
Wildcard, the Warcross series, really, really a lot to think about, a lot of action, very intriguing. And I think even though it's considered a young adult series, it's good for tech-savvy adults. If you're not tech-savvy, you might get a little lost. But and
thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
All right. And we'll see you all next week on Writers' Voices.